Yes, you've arrived at the spot for your weekly dose of Far Middle Magic. I'm Nick DeOlias, your host, and let's get started. The sports dedication this week, it's going to cover a game we haven't touched upon in 190 prior episodes. The match of the century for that game known as the Game of Kings. And I'm talking about chess and the World Chess Championship of 1972, which was a match between challenger Bobby Fischer of the United States and defending champ Boris Spassky of the Soviet Union. The match took place in Iceland. Fischer ended up becoming the first American-born individual to win the world title, and Fischer's win also ended, at least for a short time, 24 years of Soviet domination of the World Chess Championship. Spassky came in as the latest in an uninterrupted chain of Soviet world chess champs, stretching back to the 1948 championship. Now, Fischer, he was an eccentric, and I'm going to emphasize eccentric, 29-year-old American, claimed that Soviet players gained an unfair advantage by colluding in tournaments. And in 1962, he published a Sports Illustrated article that was titled, "The Russians Have Fixed World Chess." And in that article, he sort of expanded on his views. Spassky faced enormous political pressure to win the chess match. While Fischer was often famously critical of his home country, he'd say things like Americans want to do nothing more than just sit in front of a TV. They don't want to open a book. But he also carried some pressure, too, from the match with its political significance, but Spassky much more so. And the level of public interest and excitement surrounding the chess match going into it was pretty huge. Now, Spassky was already a chess legend, and fellow legend Garry Kasparov notes that, describing Spassky, from childhood, he clearly had a leaning toward sharp attacking play and possessed a splendid feel for the initiative. So that's how Kasparov described Spassky's style of play. But Bobby Fischer, he was dominant coming into that match. He sowed devastation on his path to the epic match and enjoyed actually a much higher rating than Spassky, sort of something akin to a quarterback rating in the NFL today. They have the same thing for chess players. Fischer went into that match with a much higher rating than Spassky. But for some time, it seemed as though the match might not be played at all, because shortly before the match, Fischer demanded that he and Spassky, he had a few, I'll call it financial demands. He demanded that he and Spassky receive 30% of the box office receipts, in addition to the agreed upon prize fund of $125,000. And that prize money was going to be split 5/8 to the winner and 3/8 to the loser. And then he also demanded that 30% of the proceeds from TV and film rights be allocated to Spassky and himself. So he did not arrive in Iceland in time for the opening ceremony because of these demands. The match ended up being postponed by 2 days, and Fischer finally arrived in Iceland and agreed to play after an investment banker doubled the prize fund and after a lot of persuasion, including, believe it or not, a phone call from Henry Kissinger, who at the time was the U.S. National Security Advisor. Now, you talk about international diplomacy and Kissinger, yet also applied to Bobby Fischer and the World Chess Championship. Commentators had suggested that all of this drama from Fischer and his continuing demands and his sort of weird attitude, that was just part of his plan to psych out Spassky. But Fischer supporters claimed that winning the World Chess Championship was like the mission, effectively, of Fischer's life, and that all he was looking to do was to set the perfect environment for when he took the stage. He wanted everything to be just so, and that his eccentric behavior was no different than it had always been from him. He was consistent in being inconsistent. So Fischer surprised Spassky by repeatedly switching his openings. So his style of play, his strategy, his tactics, he completely mixed them up versus what people, including Spassky, were expecting. And he was playing openings that he had never or only rarely played before. And even in openings that Fischer had played before that he used in the match, he continually deviated from the variations he had previously played. So he was very unpredictable in this championship. And he almost never repeated the same sort of line within the championship itself, or when you compared it to what his tendencies were prior. Fischer came out completely inconsistent and unpredictable from his prior form and tendencies. And that was a huge advantage The games were played from mid-July 1972 to the end of August of that year. Fischer won the match 12.5-8.5, and he became the 11th undisputed world champion. That game was covered on ABC's Wide World of Sports for those old school sports fans like me. And yes, constant listeners, chess is considered a sport by your host. If golf, pickleball, and race car driving are sports, so is chess, at least in far middle world. So there. Fischer's victory was decisive, made him an instant celebrity. He returned to New York. A Bobby Fischer Day was held. He was offered all kinds of product endorsement offers. You add them all up, they were in the millions of dollars of value. He declined every single one of them. He appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Fischer also made TV appearances on a Bob Hope special, as well as The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. But the game in this match proved to be the last public competitive games for two decades for Fischer. He ended up forfeiting his title when he refused to engage in future competitive play. As I said, he was a true eccentric, and he also had some troubling aspects of his eccentricity manifesting over the years prior to his death. Bobby Fischer might end up being a future dedication subject on the far middle of all his own, but apart from his role of our dedication subject this week, which was the match of the century in chess back in 1972, Bobby Fischer versus Boris Spassky. That chess match of the century saw some wins by each opponent, with Fischer prevailing with more wins. Let's make a connection from chess and wins and losses to extreme weather and deaths, as in whether extreme hot or cold kills more humans each year. Because a lot of people who should know the score, they don't, including the leader of the free world, at least for a few more days. July of last year, President Biden claimed extreme heat is the number one weather-related killer in the United States. Well, he was wrong, and he was wrong by a factor of 25. Yes, extreme heat kills about 6,000 Americans every year, but cold kills 150,000 plus Americans each year, 12,000 of which die from extreme cold. Even when you include deaths from moderate heat to the extreme heat totals, it ends up being less than 10,000 fatalities per year. And despite temperatures rising over the past decade or number of decades, age-adjusted extreme heat deaths, they've declined in the United States at a rate of nearly 10% a decade. Globally, age-adjusted extreme heat deaths have declined at an even greater pace because the world is enjoying greater access to energy that helps individuals and societies shield themselves from extreme weather. Air conditioners can do wonders when it comes to reducing deaths from extreme heat. When leaders misrepresent reality and then use the misrepresented reality to form policy, all in the name of perhaps chasing a favorite ideology, you can end up with a massive regulatory state, which leads us to our next connection. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch published a book last year. The title of it was Overruled: The Human Toll of Too Much Law. And it is an excellent read, and there is an interesting and funny, but when you think through it, frightening story in there. So check this story out that he had in the book. There was a magician from Missouri who went to birthday parties for kids and that type of thing, and he used the traditional rabbit and a magician's hat during his act. This guy performs his act one day at a library, and somebody in the audience comes up to him and says, "Do you have a license for that?" And that they were referring to was the rabbit that was part of his magic act. The magician was sort of stunned, and he responds, "I need a license for the rabbit." And the person who approached him answered, "I'm from the USDA. You bet you need a license." Now, it turns out that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has oversight of zoos and other animal exhibitors, and that agency has established regulations that do indeed cover backyard birthday parties and rabbits with being part of a magician's act, which means for magicians that want to use those rabbits in their magic shows, they're going to have to undergo home inspections by the government, and they're going to have to draft a disaster response plan. But that's just for rabbits and magic shows. Justice Gorsuch points out that you would not need to go through the process if you, say, used an iguana in the magic show, and that you wouldn't need to do it if you were raising the rabbits for meat. Basically, you could raise and kill the rabbit, but you can't take a rabbit across the street to a birthday party. The Justice Gorsuch book, It's a great read. He cites guesstimates that, and it's guesstimates because nobody knows for sure, if you can believe that, but guesstimates that U.S. statutory law runs 60,000 pages long and includes another 188,000 pages of regulations. Those cumulatively lay out 300,000 criminal sanctions. The effort to comply with this maze of regulation requires almost 10 billion man hours of paperwork each year by Americans and by American enterprises. And the justice identifies two directional components that he uses to explain what created this cumulative onslaught of the bureaucratic state. He defines them as up and across in our separation of powers. So by up, he means shifting responsibilities from states and municipalities up to the federal level. And by across, he means shifting authority from Congress to the administrative state of unelected bureaucrats. A few episodes back, you might recall that we discussed President Calvin Coolidge in a speech that he delivered where he pointed out how the simple and plain text of documents like the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they leave little room for subjective gray area interpretation. They're pretty straightforward and pretty basic with their principles. I had a constant listener ping me on that point to highlight that what Coolidge was really talking about was how the United States and its Constitution were based upon the principle of natural law. The subject of natural law stretches back thousands of years to the time before Christ, and we could spend an entire episode on it. And we would need, by the way, a history expert to lead that discussion, going back and sort of diving into the Roman and Greek thinkers of the ancient world. But for this episode, and with your much more limited scope that's being applied with your host, my capabilities are much more limited than that, we can skip to the chase and highlight some of the core characteristics that you will find with a society that is based upon natural law. And when I run through these, you're going to recognize many of them as also being foundations of the United States, along with our Constitution. So there's the right to be free from harm and an associated right to protect one's family. You would have a set of inalienable rights, the right to life itself and the right to property. Equal treatment under the law would be another core right. An idea of limited government to prevent tyranny and to protect individual rights, you'd also find that being present. And along with those things, the application of the concept of separation of powers and checks and balances. There are more, but do any of these sound familiar? Yeah, I think you get the point. Our Constitution is a framework whose foundation is natural law principles. The Declaration of Independence talks about holding truths that are self-evident. And what were those self-evident truths? That all men are created equal, that individuals are born with certain inalienable rights that include life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, he was mirroring the principles of natural law that inspired him and the founding fathers, and that have a lineage that stretches over thousands of years. But the United States and its embracing of natural law has its enemies on the left, and we'll make a connection to one in particular next, which is Russia. I've made a statement numerous times in the past on this podcast and in speeches and on social media, and many people question me about it because they believe it to be too much or seem too much of a conspiracy theory to be true or accurate, too fantastic of a claim. The statement is the fact, and it is indeed a fact, that Russia and its controlled interests have been large funders and backers and supporters of the Western environmental movement, particularly with respect to anti-fossil fuel and anti-fracking groups. That's true, even if it sounds like something out of a Hollywood conspiracy thriller. And despite media being silent or largely silent on that manipulation, while manufacturing falsities about other types of Russian interference and manipulation in the West, hello, Steele dossier, Western mainstream media is finally catching on to Russia's manipulation of public opinion in the West on energy matters, but this time in the context of lithium, which is a key feedstock for batteries. Last summer, massive protests in Serbia occurred to oppose a proposed lithium mine in that nation. Russia played a major role in firing up that opposition, and that's from the United States and Germany and their intelligence agencies that reported on that. Russia wanted to sabotage the development of what might be a key source of lithium for Europe. Now, what was the type of manipulative disinformation that the Russian interests were planting about the lithium mine? That the mine really wasn't about lithium as much as it was about uranium, that it would poison drinking water, and that acid rain would fall across all of Serbia, including its capital, Belgrade. All that would happen if the mine was built. Sort of ironic to see mainstream media say that the threat of acid rain is Russian disinformation when it comes to lithium mines, but that the same mainstream media a few decades ago used that scare tactic of acid rain as justification for passing the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990 in the United States, which ended up penalizing Eastern United States coal mines and power plants. Yeah, it's quite ironic. Anyway, the reason the Russians were so focused on disrupting plans for the lithium mine in Serbia is that the West needs lithium for this forced energy transition and for things like mandated electric vehicles. A new supply of lithium in places like Europe would weaken China's stranglehold on those types of supply chains. And China is a Russian ally. And of course, Russia will always want to retain influence in places like Eastern Europe and the Balkans. Serbia building a lithium mine to supply Europe would bring it closer to Western Europe, and that's a threat that Russia will take strides to avoid. Russia is all about maintaining its energy dominance over Europe, and that's why it funded and stoked the anti-fracking movement, and that's why it might be stoking tensions in Serbia with a lithium mine. And Russia, historically and currently, finds its most willing accomplice with the Western radical environmental movement. Indeed, the climate alarmist crowd plays right into Russia and China's hands. Always has, always will. Speaking of China, that's the nation that often appears to control the United Nations, directly and sometimes indirectly, which brings us to our next connection. Now we see the United Nations and its member governments, led by the lobbying of the Chinese Communist Party, adopt an agreement last year that created more power and influence of the UN over world affairs. The agreement is labeled the Pact for the Future. There's over 50 actions for governments and institutions to adopt over the coming years as prescribed by the UN. Now, one of them being transforming global governance and turning international institutions loose to pursue sustainable development and the financing for such development. There's also reference to science, technology, and innovation, along with digital cooperation. Now, speaking of digital cooperation, the pact includes a global digital compact, which is designed to restrict misinformation and disinformation. There's also a declaration on future generations, which encompasses climate goals, including the phase out of fossil fuels. All of this ties into what the UN is marketing and branding as UN 2.0. And if it's successful, UN 2.0, it's going to be scarier than the original UN monster. All of it parading around in the costume of what's best for humanity and increasing global cooperation and solving international crises. Hogwash. China loves the idea of UN 2.0. The Chinese foreign minister described the pact as an effort to galvanize the collective efforts for world peace and development and to map out the future of humanity. That should give freedom lovers serious concern. And to its credit, Argentina has come to its senses when assessing what the UN is up to, and it's moving away from the pact. Argentina's foreign minister noted that Argentina is pursuing a policy of freedom, and that Argentina wants the freedom to develop itself without being subjected to the undue weight of decisions that are alien to its goals. And as would be suspected, one of my newfound idols, Argentine President Milei, came out swinging when he addressed the UN General Assembly. He called the organization a multi-tentacled leviathan that seeks to decide what each nation state should do and how the citizens of the world should live. Yeah, he also called the UN, its 2030 agenda, a supranational program of a socialist nature. I love that guy. Now, if you take a closer look at the UN Sustainable Development Goals, you're going to see that they encompass everything from farming to healthcare to education to, of course, climate change. Leaders at the UN reference it as the master plan for humanity. That's right. UN bureaucrats being directed by the Chinese Communist Party are hard at work developing their master plan for how you're going to live your life, and much of it funded with U.S. taxpayer dollars. Of course, the UN and its puppet masters desire to gain control of dictating how individual nations respond to global emergencies, whether they be real ones or manufactured, and the former United States Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizations summed the idea up as allowing the UN to deal with this is the equivalent of putting the Chinese Communist Party in charge of global emergencies. I don't think that's a good idea. I referenced one of the aspects of UN 2.0 being the Global Digital Compact to combat misinformation and disinformation. Well, the UN defines those things as hate speech, discrimination, misinformation, disinformation, and on, all of it under the altruistic sounding information integrity. Now, if you think that's just hollow concern, consider what the Undersecretary General for Communications of the UN said a few years ago at the World Economic Forum, which is Davos, regarding a UN partnership with Google. Here's what that individual said. "We started this partnership when we were shocked to see that when we Googled climate change, we were getting incredibly distorted information right at the top. We're becoming much more proactive. We own the science, and we think that the world should know it. And the platforms themselves also do." That's what that individual stated. Yes, the United Nations working with big tech to make George Orwell nonfiction. Search Wikipedia on that Steele dossier that we mentioned, and what you read makes you think that that dossier was legitimate intelligence instead of fabricated lies. Or search Wikipedia under UN Pact for the Future that we just discussed, and you're going to read glowing propaganda. Now let's talk about Wikipedia as our next connection, shall we? It was founded over 20 years ago and had from the start an idealistic mission to provide all the world's information for free, and that the information would be gathered and updated and fact-checked by the people in a very democratic way. Effectively, utopia for reference seekers. 20 plus years later, Wikipedia is now openly attempting to manufacture its version of the truth. It's effectively operating as a propaganda resource, not an objective reference resource. A handful of influential editors get to decide what's truth and what's misinformation, and the stakes have never been higher. Now, a great example of the high stakes came to be last year in the run-up to the presidential election, over the issue as to whether Vice President Harris was indeed the border czar. Of course, that question was quite political. Republicans were trying to tag the immigration crisis on her as the czar, while Democrats were looking to pretend as if she had nothing to do with the situation at the U.S. border. And if you Googled that question during last summer leading up to Election Day, one of the first links you would encounter would be a Wikipedia article that listed presidential czars. One day, you would have been told on Wikipedia that the vice president was indeed the border czar. But then the next day, in late July, you would find that Wikipedia, that article had changed. There would be no mention of the vice president at all in the listing of presidential czars. The fact was sent down the memory hole. It never was, as far as Wikipedia was concerned. Now, when that happened, the land of Wikipedia erupted into debate over the issue. And Wikipedia was in a tough spot because its operating principles were based upon no original research, which prohibited claims from being posted where no published source existed, and that the site would ensure that information would be coming from reliable sources. If reliable means mainstream media, which for Wikipedia it inevitably does, it presented yet another problem or conundrum, because the mainstream media went from labeling the vice president as the border czar to denying that she was ever the border czar. And the flip-flop occurred after she was given the nomination to run for president and when the border became suddenly a liability for her campaign. Now, Wikipedia leans left, and it will cheerlead and broadcast the propaganda of whichever candidate, party, or issue favors the left. That's the reality when you look at the track record. The optics and the impression that Wikipedia present, they're often quite different. And those optics and that impression is that it's objective and it's authoritative and fact-based. But you look under the hood of the website page and you start to assess the process as to how the content sausage is being made, you come to understand that numerous tactics ranging from sanctions to arbitration to a host of different bans that could apply to impeach sources, they're all working together in concert to muscle a consensus that is presented at the exit of the process. And if you weaponize the process and you can control it, then what gets presented as objective fact and truth on Wikipedia can be manufactured, it can be created. That explains that example as to how Wikipedia flipped at the most sensitive of times on the vice president going from being the border czar to never having that responsibility, period. Let's checkmate this episode, shall we? We opened it with a dedication to the chess match of the century. If you search Wikipedia, which we just discussed, by typing in chess, one of the hits that you find will be the musical Chess. The music for Chess was written by Björn Ulvaeus and Benny Andersson, which are the two founding members of Swedish mega group ABBA, Benny and Björn. Chess tells the story of two chess champions, referred only to as the American and the Russian, and their fight over a woman who manages one and falls in love with the other. The musical is loosely based on that 1972 World Championship match between Fischer and Spassky that our sports dedication covered. And Chess, the concept album, came out as a double album before it hit the stage, and they released the album before the stage show to help raise money for the theater production. That was the same financial model that Evita and Jesus Christ Superstar had used. And Chess was highly acclaimed by the music press upon release. Many fans of 80s music, they know the hit single One Night in Bangkok. Remember that song by Murray Head? You know the lyrics, One Night in Bangkok makes a hard man humble. Top three hit in 1985. Well, that song is off the Chess musical concept album. Hey, stay humble over this coming week until we convene again. And always, stay connected to that far middle.